Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning
Hi, this is
New York State leaders on
this week's
a
Capital Connection.
We'll
speak
Your host
with Gary Putter,
Alan
Western
Chartow,
New York Regional Director for New Yorkers
Emeritus
Against Gun
at the University
Violence.
We'll talk
about the whole range of how to stop the killing.
The help of
so
New
join
York
us
State
for
United
the Capital
Teachers,
Connection, Thursday afternoon at 3, Saturday morning at 5:30, or anytime at wamc.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Gary Putup, the Western New York Regional Director for New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Their mission is to reduce gun violence through legislative advocacy and education designed to encourage action, influence public opinion, and lead to policy change. Gary's also a retired police commander and expert in active shooter response training. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, so give us a little bit of an overview, Gary, if you could, about how things are in terms of gun control in New York State, perhaps compared to the rest of the nation.
Well, in New York State, we're very fortunate that we were able to pass the SAFE Act in 2013. And that restricted a lot of the problems that we see in other states. In fact, what has happened, and we get this question a lot, does the SAFE Act work? And of course it does. And as more data and information comes in, we see more and more it's that our position has been strengthened. In fact, in New York State, the gun death rate from gun violence has steadily declined since the SAFE Act. We are now the third safest state in the union, behind only Hawaii and Rhode Island. And for those naysayers that might say, well, maybe gun violence, that the total rate has dropped nationally, that's just not the case. In fact, in states such as Florida, Montana, and Wyoming, which relaxed gun laws after Sandy Hook, and that's hard to imagine, but they did, but their gun death rates have actually sometimes doubled, tripled, and even quadrupled since that same time period. So we can see in New York we're doing fairly well. We haven't had the kind of problems that we have in other states, but we still need to do more. There are loopholes in the SAFE Act. There are loopholes, and there's some confusion about, you know, the strength of some of our laws, and all of those things can be strengthened.
And yet, Gary, if you go around upstate New York, you see repeal the SAFE Act all over the place. What's that about?
Well, those signs are funded by a group known as SCOPE, which is the Shooters Committee on Political Education. And they're a very active and vocal group, just as the NRA is on a national level. But when we look at things like Quinton EPAC and Siena, both did polls of upstate people, including people in areas such as the Southern Tier and the North Country, which tend to be more conservative or red, if you will. And what we find is, especially for individual provisions of the SAFE Act, there's overwhelming support, particularly amongst women and mothers. And even, this is very similar to the debate we have about Obamacare and the ACA. When people say, ask, are you in favor of Obamacare? They say no, that they're against Obamacare. But as we've seen on a national level, once you start looking at all those provisions, we see that people do favor these things. So people say things about repealing the SAFE Act. But the question I would have for those people, which part of the SAFE Act would you repeal? Universal background checks? And even most gun owners say no, that those are good ideas. And after Las Vegas, high-capacity magazines? No, we don't want to repeal that either. So when people say they want to repeal the SAFE Act, but we start to ask what individual provisions would you repeal, we find that, in fact, they do support the SAFE Act.
So, Gary Putup, let me ask you this. What do you say to people who say there are 300 million or more guns in the United States, and that's too many? What can we do about that?
Well, we certainly don't want to give up. We see from Sandy Hook to Aurora to Umpqua in the North Pacific Northwest to Las Vegas. I mean, we just can't throw up our hands and say we surrender, that we give up. No, we take this problem. And actually, one of the things about America has always been that we're willing to face our problems, come up with innovative ways to handle them, and correct this problem. This is no different. And actually, in regards to that, if I might say, the solution to this problem is not uncharted territory. It's not as if no one else has faced this problem. In fact, it's just the opposite. We're the only nation, especially amongst, you know, first world nations, that has this problems. When we look at other frontier nations, such as Canada, Australia, New Zealand, ourselves, those that share a common English common law and a common background and culture, you know, we have to ask the question, they were able to do it. Why can't we do it? And we can. We just need the political will. We need some politicians that will be willing to say, yes, this is the right thing to do. I think what's interesting on a national level is we even see some conservative and Republican senators and congressmen at a national level saying they want to revisit this bump fire issue, and that there may be need some gun control, especially in regards to those types of items.
Well, you're a former police commander. I think a lot of people assume that the police are all for all the guns we can get, but that's really not true, is it?
No, of course it's not true. In fact, one of the greatest dangers that my brother and sister police officers face is this unfettered access to these type of weapons. I can tell you that when I started as a police officer, you know, we had a revolver, we had a shotgun in the car. But things have gotten to the point today where police officers routinely have to carry assault rifles because of the threats out on the street. Look at the first people who are in the most danger to this are our first responders, both our police officers, our firefighters, and EMTs. You know, we saw that in Las Vegas. When the shooting starts, it's the police that are running towards the fire, not away from it. And I don't know any of my brothers and sisters in law enforcement that are anxious to face this kind of firepower.
So Governor Cuomo took a big chance politically by doing the SAFE Act. I thought it was the best thing he had ever done, to be perfectly honest with you, and said so, and received a telephone call thanking me for that, because I thought it was an act of some real courage, and I don't always see him that way. So here's a guy who we think may want to run for president of the United States. Will this be a good credential to have?
Well, I think it will. You know, the national conversation is, if not now, when? And we keep hearing this, and I was really very disappointed in President Trump's response to this, that, you know, he wants to put the conversation to the side. You know, I listened to Representative John Lewis last night, and he's, you know, and John Lewis has been on the forefront of this. But again, and Congresswoman Louise Slaughter from my area has been on the forefront of this. You know, and it really is, if not now, when? And then we keep saying this, but at some point, you know, we said it after Sandy Hook, we said it after Aurora. You know, maybe now with such devastation, you know, we hope that at some point in time, there will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and the camel being the National Rifle Association, and that we will start getting, start to see some action. I think the governor was ahead of his time when he passed the SAFE Act, and it was a brave, courageous thing to do. And I think history and time are going to show that he was on the right side of this issue. I believe that there is starting to be a more and more of a feeling, even amongst communities that have tended to be more maybe conservative or right wing on this, that they're going to start to see what the issue is. It's sad to say that sometimes each community or individual has to be affected before they really understand the problem. I think it's telling that some of the members of the musicians and the members of the musical groups that were playing at this particular music festival have come out and stated that they were very pro Second Amendment and very gun rights and didn't want to see any restrictions. And now that they've seen the devastation that these things can wreck on large numbers of innocent people, that they have changed their minds. And even these people are starting to ask for gun control now.
Now, Congressman Chris Collins up in the Niagara area wants to repeal the SAFE Act. And you say that New York needs federal legislation to back up New York State's leadership on gun control. Well, with this group in the Congress, this Republican group in control, one would think it's not likely to happen. Although I have to say two encouraging things that I've seen. One, the speaker has laid aside the idea that you're going to have silencer legislation, which will make it easier to get silencers. And the other, of course, is the idea that machinery, which will allow taking ordinary guns and making them into machine guns, might be outlawed. What do you think?
Well, I think it is going to be difficult because we have a Republican Congress, both in the House and the Senate. And you know, I'm trying to look at this realistically. And I think we can also have a discussion about money and politics. And I think your listeners and you're very well educated. You understand what the issues are. And what, you know, this is just the big tobacco of the 2000s. You know, we had the same issue with getting, you know, bans and regulation in regards to tobacco. And we saw what money can do in politics. But money can go so far. Money cannot compensate for the grief and sorrow that families are feeling today. Money cannot alleviate the pain that this nation continually goes through on a regular basis with not only these mass shootings, but the 90 people we lose every day to gun violence. At some point in time, money will go so far, and I'm hoping that human decency kicks in and that we will get these things passed.
We're talking to Gary Putup, the Western New York Regional Director for New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. Gary, let me take you to domestic violence. I'm wondering, I don't know, I'm not familiar with the polling, but I wonder where men and women are on this versus each other. Is there an indication, as I would suspect, that women are more likely to favor gun control than men? Am I right about that?
Yes, you are. I'm glad you brought that up. Those polls that we talked about earlier in the show, one of the things that they showed that women are much more in favor of reasonable gun control, common sense, you know, regulation. And primarily one of the reasons are is because they are disproportionately the victims of violence and domestic violence. And in the United States, that violence takes the form of gun violence. Domestic violence on a whole doesn't occur any more or less than it does, again, in nations like Canada or the UK. What makes the difference is the easy access to guns. And not only when the gun is used, you know, in that physical manner to actually shoot or kill the woman, but it also serves as a psychological threat. I've talked to many domestic violence workers here in my area and across the state. And one of the things that happens, you know, it's hard to pin down the data, but one of the things that happens is when the woman is in one of these situations, and we know enough now not to blame the victim, and that there are many reasons why women stay in domestic violence situations, but one of the constant threats that they live with is knowing that there's a gun in the house and there's nothing that they can do about that, and that hangs over their heads. One of the things that we want to do here in New York State is pass a law, which Connecticut and I believe California already have, called the Emergency Restraint Protection Order. And what this would do is would be very similar to an order of protection in a domestic violence situation, where friends and family could go to the police or go to a court and petition the court to have guns temporarily taken from somebody at risk. When we see what happened in Las Vegas, you know, we will learn, I'm going to guess, and I'm going to preface that it is a guess, but there are going to be at some point in time people that say, or at least in some of these cases, maybe I shouldn't speak so in this manner, but we do know in some of these cases, like Columbine and others, that there were warning signs to the friends and families that something just wasn't right with an individual. As the law stands now, if that person owns guns, there's no way to prevent that person from having access to those guns. What the emergency protection order would do, it would allow people to go in front of a court, you know, an objective court, file a petition, and have those guns temporarily removed until that person's personal crisis is over, whether it's, you know, an anger management issue with a domestic situation or maybe some other kind of psychological crisis that they're going through. It's worked in other states, you know, and this is, again, not only domestic violence, but again, one of the big problems we have is with suicides and guns. And we also hope that it would do that. So that's something positive, again, we can do in New York State.
Gary, I want to talk to you about something that happens in Albany. It's not the biggest program in the world, but it is a gun buyback program. You know, everybody says, well, how are you going to get rid of them all? You're not, but at least you can make an effort.
Yes, and there's some question as to, you know, sometimes we'll hear criticism that they're not very effective. And, you know, I don't agree with that. There's going to be no silver bullet to this problem. There's not going to be, you know, it's like cancer. There's not going to be one cure that cures all cancers. And gun violence is like a cancer. You have instances like you saw in Las Vegas where, you know, basically somebody just, you know, snapped and has all these weapons and use them. You have incidents involving accidents where a child finds a gun that's left lying around the house and shoots a family member, a sibling, or a neighbor. And we have the domestic violence. We have the suicides. And all of these things are going to take different different ways to cure them. If in these gun buybacks, if we're just taking a couple of hundred guns off the street and out of situations where someone might have bad thoughts, dark thoughts, and we've all had blue days, maybe not as serious, some is not as serious as others. But if that prevents a suicide, if that prevents a child from accidentally loading that weapon or finding a loaded weapon and killing a neighbor, then it's worth it. You know, it's what price are we going to put on that? And I think that they are effective to deal with what they have to deal with, but they're not going to be the only answer.
Okay, I want to go through some of the cures, some of the things that could be done. Let's start with federal expanding background checks. How does that work?
Yes. Well, you know, it's worked very well in New York. Prior to the SAFE Act, there were no universal background checks. And quite frankly, sometimes I'm a little reluctant to use the term universal background check in New York because you're still allowed to turn a weapon over to a family member without a background check. And although we would like to think that we all know our family members and we would know best, here's the problem I see with that. I live in Rochester, New York. I have a brother that lives downstate, outside the New York City area. I see him once or twice a year. Why should I be able to give him a gun without a background check? I have no idea what groups he belongs to. I have no idea what's going on with him from a day-to-day basis. You know, is he someone like the gentleman out in Las Vegas? You know, I don't know that. I think there should be universal background checks. But one of the things we have seen since the SAFE Act is, again, and we believe that it has contributed to the lowering of our gun death rate, is that all gun sales have to have a background check now. Prior to the SAFE Act, you and I could literally meet in a bar, and me not knowing you could strike up a conversation, and I could have said, you know, I have this assault rifle. It's in the trunk of my car. You know what? My wife is just mad at me for spending all this money. And if you said, Gary, I'll give you $1,000 for it, would walk out to the parking lot, I'd open up the trunk, and it's yours. You know, so we do need that kind of thing on a national level. Almost 40% of the sales of firearms are in that secondary used market. You know, the idea that we have, like you said, these millions and millions of guns out there and that they're being transferred from people. You know, there's no way to know if somebody should or shouldn't have a gun. Are they selling it to somebody that's psychotic? Are you selling it to a Hell's Angel? Are you selling it to a gangbanger? Are you selling it to somebody that has a history of domestic violence? We don't know. That's certainly one of the first steps we should be taking.
Tell me about micro-stamping to help law enforcement.
Well, micro-stamping would help law enforcement. What micro-stamping is for those who don't know, there's a technology exists today that on every firearm obviously has a firing pin. That's the way they work. And what you would be done is on the firing pin would be a discrete number, similar to like a serial number on the rifle and or on the firearm. And what would happen is as the firing pin hits the primer on the cartridge, I hope this isn't too technical, but people that understand firearms know what I'm speaking about, it leaves a little imprint. And the micro stamping is it would leave a little micro number, a discrete number, identifying number on that primer. So what would happen, so what would it enable us in law enforcement to do is when we show up at a crime scene now, we've seen all the famous photos of crime scenes where there's bullet casings lying about, and the police pick them up and they save them as evidence. The problem now is you have to then find the gun, test the gun, and see if by the markings on the casings, if that's the gun that was used. What would allow law enforcement to do is they could take those casings, look at that casing and say, we know which gun it is. Now all we have to do is find the gun.
So
that would make things a lot easier.
So can't the perps get around that by filing it off or doing something like that?
You know, they could file it off. The problem with filing it off is when you file off the firing pin, it doesn't work anymore. Oh. The other issue is we've heard people say, well, I can make another firing pin. Well, you know, you can make a gun, in a tool and die shop, but people don't do it. It's not that easy. And a lot of people that commit these crimes, these are crimes of passion, or like, again, you know, maybe you have gang members in that. They don't really have the ability to do that, and sometimes that's not the thought process that they're going through. And then when you have a situation like we saw in Las Vegas, now we don't know in that case whether he intended to go or not, but in many of these mass shootings like Columbine and others, what the FBI and profilers are saying, these people go in there knowing that they're either going to commit suicide or they're going to be killed by the police. You know, a person like that, they don't care if it has micro stamping or a serial number or not.
I want to talk to you about children, because children are great risk, Gary Putup. And we know that an awful lot of kids have access to guns and they kill themselves, whether they or somebody else, whether they like it or not. It's not on purpose. I suppose there must be ways to deal with that.
Certainly there are ways to deal with that. And I'm glad to see, you know, here that I assume you are on our website and we have some information about that. And our organization and others such as Brady and Moms Demand Action are very involved with this. And we have a program called the ASK program. And what the ASK program is that we are asking people that are caregivers, mothers, grandmothers, aunts, uncles, whatever, that before your child goes to play with another child, has a play date, to ask that person, is there a loaded gun in the house? Or is there a gun in the house? Is it loaded? Is it secured? Because it's sad on how many cases there are. Not only kids just finding guns, playing with them and hurting themselves, but then sometimes they'll bring them to school. I'll tell you that some of the saddest cases I handled as a police commander was teen suicides. One of my jobs as a police commander is I had to respond to all fatal accidents, you know, anytime there was an unnatural death or a suicide. And suicide is a whole nother issue that we just don't talk about that much in this country. And the problem is very often it's done with a firearm. And these two teen suicides with firearms, and one issue with a suicide with firearm is it's so effective. There's no turning back. It's not like an overdose or some other methods, which tend not to fail. Firearms are very effective in regards to suicide. And there's two issues. People that attempt suicide and then get help tend to never commit suicide again. A firearm doesn't allow that. The other problem I saw time and again is I would have a gun owner say, I never thought my kid was in trouble. If I thought my kid was in trouble, I would have locked the gun up. Well, of course they would have. I don't know any parent that would leave a loaded gun lying around knowing that their kid was in trouble. But here's what we all know, and we learned a little bit of this in Columbine too, and I learned this on many of these teen suicides. Sometimes, and if you've ever had a teenager, the parents are the last to know. You know, his son goes to school, his girlfriend breaks up with him. He had a bad test score. Life just seems, you know, overbearing. And they come home, and dad is convinced that his son knows how to use guns and respects guns. But dad leaves it out for personal protection from the home invasion, which is probably never going to occur. And then something tragic happens. We can have safe storage. In the city of Albany, 2 years ago, we were instrumental in getting a Safe Storage Act passed. In the city of Albany itself, almost, I think it's a gun is stolen every 7 to 10 days in the city of Albany. That's in the city of Albany, which isn't necessarily a huge city, but part of that problem is people will do things like they'll go somewhere, whether it's their public library, a government building, to a sporting event, they carry a gun and then they just throw it in the glove box. Some people leaving guns in their cars 24/7 just in case. Well, they get stolen. When they're on the street, they're a danger to police officers. They're a danger to children.
Gary?
And you know, so we really advocate for safe storage laws, or at least the education.
Gary Putup, we are out of time. This has been a most interesting program, and we thank you for doing it. Gary Putup is the Western New York Regional Director for New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, a former police commander. Gary, I'm very impressed with what I heard from you today. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been an honor to be on your show.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.